last week we've been working our way gradually through bits of Indian history and relevant things, and last week we were talking about King Ashoka and various developments and things are happening around that time. What I would like to do this week is to talk about the schisms and the origins of schools of Buddhism. And that was last week.
Oh, was it not?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the online.
Okay. We'll just make sure we keep any elephants out of the room.
Okay. last week, as I you basically established that that there wasn't really a lack of schisms, mm-hmm. but the fact that there were, because wasn't this edict confused about that they thought the edicts were written because so now I'm confused.
The basic situation in the time of Ashoka is that there's no real evidence that there were any schisms in the time of Ashoka.
That's what I was trying to say. Yeah.
Yep. Even though it's often taken to be the case, but normally taken to be the case that there were schisms there. So whenever you read books about Buddhist history, they'll almost invariably say that there were schisms by the time of King Ashoka.
And so people believe you wrote that for that reason, but that's not really the reason.
Yeah, because it says that the Sangha has been made unified.
That's right. That's
yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that stuff was all in sect and sectarianism, which, of course, has all the details and analysis and blah, blah, blah. This is the schism edict. Sangha of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis has been made unified as long as my children and grandchildren shall live, as long as the sun and the moon shall shine. Any bhikkhu or bhikkhuni who divides the sangha shall be made to wear white clothes and dwell outside the monasteries. What is my wish? That the unity of the Sangha should last a long time. Okay, so this is the Ashokan edict. As you can see, it clearly depicts a state of unity in the Sangha. And that's the actual image of that edict, which is a photo taken by our friend Kim Din when we were on pilgrimage in India. That's the one at Sarnath. Actually, the edict's found in three places. I don't think I talked about, no. Last week we weren't talking about the schisms as such. No.
Okay.
So we're talking about that tonight. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Because I wasn't sure whether that schisms within the community that caused disruption, or whether he meant schisms as in Buddhism moving to different countries and adapting different causes and things like that.
Right. Right,
so
right.
I'm not sure which way he meant.
Exactly. That's basically the crux of the problem. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because you have a definition of schism in the Vinaya, which is very precise. Vinaya is a legal instrument, and so it has a very precise definition of schism.
Yeah.
And the definition of schism in the Vinaya is that two groups of sangha, either bhikkhus or bhikkhunis, although bhikkhunis can't cause a schism in the bhikkhu sangha. Right, so there's that kind of thing. But the bhikkhus or bhikkhunis, say two groups of four, it actually has to be more than that, I can't remember the exact numbers now. Anyway, two groups performing the patimokkha, performing the upasaka separately, mm-hmm. within the same sema. Okay?
Oh, so that's considered a schism.
That is for, with intending and aiming at causing a schism.
Okay.
Yeah? If they do it because they've just got the time wrong, okay? Yeah. And they arrive there, one does in the morning, one does in the afternoon, then that's different, that's not a schism. But they have to deliberately intend to cause a schism. And the legal instrument by which they do that is that within the same monastic boundary that they perform upasaka separately.
Okay.
All right?
So is it limited to that context? Or is
that's the only meaning of schism according to the Vinaya.
Okay, so what about, when there are times, when you look at the story of the Buddha, there were times where, I think, was it one of his cousins or something?
Devadatta,
yeah. Devadatta afraid from him and went off.
That's right.
And that, so that was, but I consider that to be a schism.
That's exactly what he did. That's exactly what he did, and that's the context that it's described in the Vinaya.
Okay.
It's the context of Devadatta.
The
Upasata, which is where the recitation of the Parimokkha rules each fortnight. So we recite them every fortnight. So that the purpose of the Upasata is like a reaffirmation of community identity. So everyone has to be there in harmony and perform that. And so because that's the purpose of that, then when you do that separately, then that marks a schism. All right. So of course the problem is that now then the legal apparatus about schisms was laid down with regard to Devadatta. Okay? And Devadatta, of course, was maliciously and with an evil intent trying to divide the Sangha, right? And so then it says, in that chapter, it says anybody who does that maliciously and with that bad, evil intent to declare what is Dhamma is not Dhamma and what is Vinaya is not Vinaya, okay, then they will go to hell for the eon. All right?
So there is a little bit of Christian thinking there.
So, and of course it's talking about Devadatta, right? But it becomes understood in the Buddhist tradition that anybody who separates the Sangha or causes separation is like a really evil person who's going to go to hell, right? But that's not the case. That's not what it says in the Vinaya at all. You have to be deliberately knowing that what I'm teaching is against the Dhamma and is against the Vinaya, and deliberately intending to split the Sangha on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's like the schism in the really bad sense. Right? So this is one of the problems, and then the question arises of, are the schisms or are the separations of schools in Buddhism schism in that sense?
That's what I was trying to get at.
Exactly, yeah.
Clarifying that point.
Exactly. And so my answer to that is no, it's not. And that there's little or no evidence that there has ever... My feeling is that basically everybody since the time of Devadatta has been so terrified of going to hell that the last thing they're going to do is cause a schism in that way.
He came back, though, in the end, didn't he? He came back and asked for the Buddhist forgiveness and apologised and realised his mistake, if I remember the story correctly.
I'm not sure. According to the Pali texts, the earth opened up and swallowed him and dragged him down to hell.
But I think he went back to see the Buddha too.
There may be, I do remember something like that.
Yeah, because I remember reading, well, the source of my information is kind of like, it's getting a heart of pathway clouds.
Right.
You familiar with that one?
Vaguely, yeah.
Okay, well, that's quite a fact book on the history.
Yeah.
And he's taken that from many, apparently from many of the sources. Yeah, so that's where I'm getting my information.
There's a lot of legends.
Is it? Yeah, I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So, it could well be that, you know, Devadatta's a favourite character of all the legends and so on. So, yeah, there could be something like that. I mean, certainly there's a widespread tradition that in the end he's redeemed, you know, so in the future he's supposed to be a Pacheka Buddha or something like that.
Okay.
So that's quite widely accepted, but yeah.
So, I mean, you might have said that, I don't know. In terms of Vinaya, then, does Vinaya cover that situation, like in present moment? Like if someone did that, but then they realised their mistake and came back, would they be allowed to come back in? Or
yeah.
Is it a major offence?
Yeah, no, they can come back in.
It's
yeah. Well, it's still a major offence, but it's a redeemable offence. It's not
a
priority. You can
right.
Yeah, yeah. So you can heal it from a schism if somebody sees their mistake.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
All right, no, that's good to clarify all those things. So this was one of the reasons, and the reason I got into doing this research for sectarianism was about, as usual, for bhikkhuni ordination and the idea behind the Theravadan school that you can't have bhikkhunis because they're quote-unquote Mahayana, and therefore you can't have anything to do with them. So I wanted to research about the origins of these, and I found that originally, actually, I wanted to just write a bit of a chapter that would summarize the research on this for a book on Bhikkhuni Vinaya. But as I got into it, I realized that a lot of the things which I was reading in the even the scholarly accounts, that I didn't find all that plausible. And the more I went into the sources, the more I felt that the modern discourse on this had been badly skewed by a number of problems. for example, a lot of the early Western scholars were overly influenced by the Pali texts and tended to sometimes give them more credence than they were due in certain cases. In other cases, there were theses which were put forward 100 years ago and became kind of accepted within the kind of scholarly environment, which didn't, but they didn't actually add up with later evidence that was found or broader research in the texts, and yet they hadn't been revised and things like this. So basically, I went through and all of the original texts and inscriptions and things again. So I'm not going to bore you with all that stuff. You can read the book if you want and have a look at the website. So there's a book, Sex and Sectarianism, and there's also this series of essays. So they're all, that's basically another book's worth of essays on the whole thing. So I'm not going to go too much into all of those things. But what I would like to do, anyway, that's basically my conclusion. So just to sort of flip over to the easy bit and the end part, is that there weren't any schisms before the time of Ashoka, that the Sangha gradually divided after the time of Ashoka. The main reason for the division of the Sangha, of the emergence of most of the schools, was simply geographical dispersion. Okay? And so that the Sangha divided out because it went to different areas in India and became gradually dispersed and separated. In addition to that, there were a number of particular schools that particularly emerged because of specific and serious doctrinal disputes. And they were this original split between the Staviras and the Mahasanghikas, and that was over the 5 points or the 5 theses. Okay? And then there's the split with the Sarvasivadins, which happened over the understanding of impermanence. So the 5 theses basically concern the nature of the Arahant. Okay? So this is an important question. So the schisms didn't happen about minor issues, they happened about major issues. One was about the nature of the Arahant, what's the nature of enlightenment. The Sarvasivadin schism happened because of question, what's the nature of impermanence? Okay? How do we understand impermanence and continuity? That's the Sarvasivadin schism. And the Pugalavadin schism happened because of understanding of not-self. Okay? So how do we equate our sense of personal identity with the teaching of not-self? We feel like we're a person. Yeah, and in some places the Buddha talked about being a person did this or a person did that, and how does this add up with the doctrine of not-self? Okay, so that's, again, these are all quite serious and legitimate doctrinal discussions to have within Buddhism. And, you know, we can well understand that they're not simple matters, and that, you know, groups of Buddhists may well legitimately come to different conclusions about them. Okay, and so we can look at those things and see which we feel is the most reasonable interpretation. But what I'd like to do this afternoon is rather than talk too much about these things in abstract, is just introduce you to some of the main texts that these things are all based on, so you can get a bit of an idea of what the sources are for these things. Okay. Now, so I might just there's some interesting books here. I might just run through these books here just so you can get an idea of them. This one is an excellent little booklet, The Literature of the Personalists of Early Buddhism. I can highly recommend the font size. It's very small. And got lots of things in Chinese and Sanskrit, and, you know, like footnotes which are that big on the page and stuff like that. So it's really good. And this actually summarizes and analyzes. There's 4 existing treatises of the Pugalavadin school that exist in Chinese translation, and that's all that we know of them. So these are Pugalavadins are a bit like the Gnostics in Christianity. They completely disappeared, and we only know about them from the attacks from their enemies, generally speaking. But there's actually 4 treaties of theirs that actually exist, and so that gives their side of the story, which is actually very interesting, and they had quite a subtle philosophy. So that's interesting. This one, I'll read out from that in a minute. This one is very interesting. This is a classic Taranatha, History of Buddhism in India. This is a late history. I think it's like 17th or 18th century. No, sorry. That wrote this book in 1608 in Tibetan, Taranatha, Tibetan scholar. a Tibetan scholar. Tibet. Yeah.
When you say Tibetan scholar,
a scholar from Tibet, yeah. Tibetan monk. Okay, no, fair enough. And so this is like a critical history of Indian Buddhism. So he'd interpreted his sources, and then he went back to his sources and argued which ones were reliable, which ones weren't, and these kinds of things. So it's a very interesting account of the history of Indian Buddhism. This is one of the main source works used. No, I'm not sure, but it's based on older Tibetan histories. Yeah. So it's a critical compilation of that. So that's interesting. And this is an earlier Tibetan work, I think. Bhutan, what does it say? 12th and 13th centuries, something like that. So this probably was one of the source works which Tohunata used. And again, a history of Buddhism in India and Tibet. So it gives lots of stories and details and things like that. They are. You have to admit. Well, that's full of good stuff, what can I say? Yeah. This is a bit misleading. It's not going to give you much of an idea from the title. The Inception of Discipline and the Vinaya Nidana, which is probably completely meaningless. But this is actually the introduction to the Samantabhasadika, which is the Vinaya commentary in Pali. Okay, and this basically gives the story from the Buddha's passing away up until the bringing of the Dhamma to Sri Lanka. Okay? And this particular text is the one which I concluded of all of the texts gives the most reliable account, especially of the period of Ashoka and things like that. One reason being that it agrees very well with the archaeological record. Okay? So this that's well worth having a read to see. This is one of the things that I found in doing the research is there's actually almost like two completely separate streams of this history of this period within the Pali school. Okay, one stream is found in here. This doesn't mention anything about schism or about the emergence of schools or anything like that. Okay, and it's just talking about how Buddhism grew and developed and how it spread across India. One of the outstanding things that we have from here is a list of the missionaries, Dhamma missionaries, who went to different places. Now, this particular whole passage is also found in the Chinese translation, okay, an ancient Chinese translation from Sri Lanka. And so, after the supposed Third Council in Pataliputta, held by Moggaliputta, he then goes on to tell the story of establishing the Dhamma in the different areas. And so he says, Moggaliputta, who's the leader of the Third Council in the time of Ashoka, said, "Where will the dispensation be firmly established in the future?" And as he reflected, it so occurred to him, it will be firmly established in the border districts, which is kind of interesting that they're seeming to establish the authority of like the almost like the colonies are trying to establish their authority as being firmly established, whereas in the heartland Buddhism was going to decay. Handing over the responsibility to various groups of monks, he sent those monks in these respective directions. He sent the elder Madhyantika to the kingdom of Kashmira and Gandhara, saying, "You go to that kingdom and establish the dispensation there." Now that one is interesting because that's also confirmed right throughout the northern literature, Mulasarasivada Vinaya and many other places. They also talk about Madhyantika going to Kashmir and establishing the sasana there. Making. Oh. Where are we? Oh, we had a good one before. Where was that?
To the university one. The teardrop on the end of the aisle.
So this is the best one. Things which was best. That's ancient history. That's not good.
Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, there you go. So this one is not so clear, but it's got more information on it. But anyway, okay, here we go. So this is the, again, this is the kind of middle country. So this is the area that the Buddha went as far as Kuru country up here, down to Ujjaini, down here, Avanti, just occasionally went over this far west, and Mathura I visited once or twice. He said, it's dusty, the roads are uneven, there's lots of dogs and there's vicious yuccas and you can't get any alms food. That was his summary of Mathura. It's just this little sutra that says, what are the five disadvantages of Mathura? Yeah. Obviously, he didn't have a great time there. And it mentions the Magadha and Anga. And so this area, that was the area that the Buddha walked in and travelled in. Occasionally, the sutras mentioned down as far as here, once or twice. So where are these guys going? So Madhyantika went up to Kashmir and Gandhara. So here's Gandhara up here. Kashmir is not on that map mentioned, but it's actually just above there. Oh, just below, I think. Where is Kashmir? Yeah, Kashmir is here. Gandhara, very close. Up here, Taxila was the ancient university city. Apparently they're just going to revive that. Cambodia. Of course, modern pronunciation is Cambodia. A different place, same name. I think so, yeah. Afghanistan, yeah. It's either in Pakistan or Afghanistan, I'm not 100% sure. So that's where Madhyantika went up and he had this big fight and with the Naga. Do you want to hear about the fight with the Naga king? Okay, so you can see at that time. They all had fights with Nagas and stuff like that. It gets a bit tedious after a while. But the Naga king was actually the husband Panchala, who was the husband of Haridi, one of my favorite yakinis. So fought for him and. You know, the wind blew from the mount from every direction. Trees were uprooted, mountain peaks were shattered, thunder roared, lightning flashed, thunderbolts crashed, water streamed forth as though the sky were rent asunder, and Naga youths congregated, assuming hideous shapes, and so on. And he came and intimidated the elder with harsh words such as, "Who is this shaven-headed recluse draped in a yellow patchwork garment of tattered rags?" And he commanded the Naga hosts, "Oh, come, capture this monk, bind him, exterminate him." Mm. Exterminate. As I said, Dalek. The elder warded off these with his psychic powers, of course, and said, "Great Naga, even if you were to raise up the whole earth together with its oceans and mountains and hurl it upon me, you will not be able to produce in me fear and dismay." So then the Naga became sad and dejected, and then the monk gave a Dhamma discourse, and then many of the Nagas, as well as the Yakas, Gandhabas, and so on, were converted. And the Yaka Panchaka, together with the Yakini, his wife, it's not mentioned by name here, but is Hariti in other sources. That's when he was in Kashmir already. He was the local deity.
Well, he's an animal, isn't he?
They still worship him.
That's on the way to the rotating pass, which has always been a very important pass for the Himalaya.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it could well have been, yeah. Yeah, they're quite long lived. So then they all gathered, and he gave them a teaching, and then they all became stream enterers, all the Nagas and stuff. So obviously, Ajantika. Thereupon, he gave this verse: from this day, no longer give rise to anger as before. Do not destroy crops, for beings desire happiness. Notice the connection with crops. The Nagas would have been worshipped as fertility deities. Extend love to creatures and let men live happily. And then they did as they were told. Then there was a day for coming and paying homage to the Naga king. The Naga king had his jeweled throne brought to him and had prepared for the elder, Majhantika. The elder sat upon the throne and the Naga king stood there fanning the elder. The inhabitants of Kashmira Gandhara, who came at the time, saw the elder and thinking, the elder possesses greater supernatural powers than our Naga king, venerated the elder himself and sat down. And then he taught them the Asi Visopama Sutta, and then 80,000 beings became stream enterers, and 100,000 men ordained. Thereupon, from there up to the present day, the land of Kashmir has been aglow with the yellow robe and been fanned with a breeze hallowed by sages. So certainly that last part of it is true. It was a very, very strong Buddhist stronghold. But the important thing, the critical thing about there is to see this is a very, very typical example of the conversion techniques that were used by the Buddhists all over India. Same thing in Sri Lanka, same thing in Southeast Asia, is that they adopted the local Naga cults or spirit cults or Yaka cults and so on, and they became subsumed within Buddhism. And so it wasn't a question of trying to prevent those cults or exterminate them, but rather adopting them within Buddhism. And they would still allow those practices to go on. Right, so you see, even up to these days, you still find Nagas represented in the Buddhist temples all over Asia and so on. So they didn't try to exterminate them, but they would try to subsume them within Buddhism and say, that's fine, Nagas have got powers and that's fine, but we've got more.
Right? So what was the, just quickly summarize the Sutta dispense?
Oh, I don't know. I know there's a name of it here, but it doesn't actually give the Sutta here. I see yourself. I'm not sure.
So you don't. Oh, you don't know.
I don't know what. I don't know what I have. I'm found. Yeah.
Because I was curious as to what he said. Yeah. Study that one, real quick.
Yeah. Oh, there's all different ones. Each one they teach a different sutta in different places. Okay, so he's up here. Then next one was, and then he sent Venerable Mahadeva to Mahisaka or Mahinsaka. And this is probably the founding of the school we know as the Mahishasaka school, and I think the region is down here somewhere in Ujjaini somewhere. I think this one's a bit disputed where exactly that is. And then converted 40,000 beings and so on and so forth. Venerable Rakita went to Vanavasi, which is difficult to identify. Vanavasi just means the forest land. See, there's a note here, 67. I haven't identified it. No, that doesn't say. So, not quite sure where Vanavasi is. Rakita and converted them, and 60,000 of them. Dhamma Rakita, the Greek, went to the Western lands and converted the people of the Western lands with a discourse on the great mass of fire. And interestingly enough, 37,000 beings became stream enterers, 1,000 men and 6,000 women ordained. In this manner, he established the dispensation there. So this was the, right from the beginning, the Westerners were leading the way with bikuni ordination.
Yeah, all women's clubs and all boys' clubs, that's to be
here somewhere. He's mentioned as being in a few places. Yonikadama Rakita he was born in Alexandria. Oh, and of course, there's several Alexandrias in the region, this is a Greekish empire here. He's also associated with down here, but he probably was in that region somewhere. Probably in a few different places, I'm sure. He could have travelled further west, but he's mentioned as coming from. Let's see if it's in here. I think he's associated with the area down here. There is an Alexandria somewhere in that region, but I can't come from these maps. Okay, then Mahadhammarakita went to Maharatha. Maharatha just means great country. So it could well have changed its name. Probably is. It's the same over here somewhere. That's listed as Surashtra, which could well be the same name. Yeah, so this area anyway. Somewhere over there. And Maharakita went to the Greek kingdom and converted the Greek world with a discourse on the Kalakarama Suttanta. Okay? So there's possibly some confusion because it's got Dhammarakita the Greek, and then it's got Maharakita who went to the Greek kingdom. Alright? So it's possibly the same person. In either case, I think that it was Dhammarakita who in the Chinese version of this text is called Tamudo, which is the translation of Dharmagupta. And I think he was the founder of the Dharmaguptaka school. Okay, so this is one of the arguments that I make in Sects and Sectarianism, that this particular Dhammarakita, or Dharmaguptaka, the same word, Dhammarakita and Gupta mean the same thing. And the Chinese version of it, he's called Gupta, or Dhammagupta, and so I think he was the founder of the Dhammaguptaka school, in the same way that the monk Mahadeva who went to Mahisasika was probably the founder of the Mahishasika school. Majima, who went up to Kashmir, was probably the founder of the Savasivadan Kashmir school, the Kashmiri school of Savasivada. Rakita, and then Majima, together with Kasapagota, Alakadeva, Dundu Bhisara, which means the sound of drums. Dundubi is the word for a drum in Pali. And Mahadeva went to the Himalayas. Okay, so they all went up here somewhere, and then converted their five kingdoms and ordained 100,000 under each. Now it's poetic. Actually, in Lamotte, he's got a table. One of the interesting things is that you find that in each case, this is very, very close to the Chinese version of this, except one difference is that in each case, the numbers of people converted is much less in the Chinese version. I don't know if I can find the table here. So in other words, the Pali version has greatly exaggerated the numbers, and this is one of the reasons why I think the Chinese version of this particular text is earlier than the Pali version. Okay. So these guys, Majima, Kasapagota, Alakadeva, Dundubhisara, and Mahadeva, all went up to the Himalayas. Okay? Did their thing, converted everybody, and so on. Now, the special thing about these guys, and I'm just wondering where to find the information on this. The special thing about these guys is Oh, really? Yeah, this is it. Can't exactly find it. There's a specific article on that, which has the details. Okay, when the British arrived in India, they killed a lot of people and took it over and did lots of terrible things, but they did do some good things as well, and one of the good things that they did was to rediscover a lot of the Buddhist sites. So our modern knowledge of Buddhist history is basically derived from the work that the early English archaeologists did. This is the late 19th century, which they largely based on the work of the books of the Chinese pilgrims. Now, one of the things that they did is they excavated a very large stupa at Sanchi, and this is one of the great works of Buddhist, Buddhist cultural icons in ever, and in Madhya Pradesh, it's on the western part of Madhya Pradesh, it's kind of over here somewhere. That. There you go, there's Sanchi there. Now, one of the things that so rediscovered around 1818, now, many, many interesting things about the Sanchi stupa, but one of the key things. To see if it references this, it doesn't talk about it here. Key things is it had, as well as the major stupa, which you see here, there's various minor stupas around the place. Now, we assume that in the major stupa, originally built in the time of Ashoka, that he would have put the Buddha relics in there. All right. So they dug down, so there's probably real, actual Buddha relics in there. They dug down there, they couldn't find them. Okay, so they're still there, which is probably a good thing. As well as that major one, they then had minor stupas around the place which were dedicated to various disciples. The two minor ones were Sariputra Moggallana, and that's where they found the Sariputra Moggallana relics, which are currently underneath the main shrine in the Mahabodhi Society in Bodhgaya. Yeah. Which we were lucky, we actually took them out from underneath the shrine a couple of years ago and had our photos taken with them. Yeah. So that's that. Now, and then some of the minor ones, again, what was the interesting thing was that they then had these little stupas, smaller stupas, which were for individual monks, okay, who it seems were kind of like local heroes or local saints, the leaders of the local sangha, right, not necessarily sort of the great disciples known to everybody. And in that group of local stupas, they actually inscribed the names of them. So this is the first mention, archaeological mention of actual personal names of monks in Buddhist history. And lo and behold, the names of the monks were these ones mentioned here in the account of the this is a particular text here in the Pali Vinaya commentary. The five that went to the Himalayas. Yeah. So here's a little table that I drew up with summarizing this information. And so these are the different stupas at Sanchi. Sonari stupa, these are just the close ones close by Sanchi. Okay. So the Pali texts give Majima as the name. So reliquaries at Sonari stupa 2 is Majima Kosiniputta. And Sanchi is Majima Kosiniputta. Kasapagotta. Kotiputta Kasapagota, Kasapagota. Alavakadeva is Alabagira and Alabagira. Sahadeva, this one is it's not so obvious, but there's various scholarly discussions, and there's no question that it is actually the same person. And Dundubhisara is called Gotiputta Dundubhisara Dayada. This may be Dundubhisara, or it may be the heir of Dundubhisara. Dayada means the heir. Okay? So it's probably not the same person. It's probably somebody who is his like Dhamma heir or follower. Yeah. But nevertheless, there's no doubt that you're talking about the same people here. And so this is interesting. And then one of the interesting things is that the ones not mentioned in that account are also featuring our story. Mogaliputta was the name of one of the leaders at the second council, the third council we already have him. Vachiputta or Vachia was supposed to be the founder of the Pugalavadana school. Haritiputta, interestingly enough, Hariti we already mentioned was the name of the Yakini in Kashmir. Now why is the son of a Yakini? Why is she doing here? But also Koti or Goti, these are also the names of Yakinis, as is Alaba or Alabaka. This is also the name, these are all the names of Yakinis. So one of my theories is that when the Buddhists did their conversion in the different areas, they would adopt the local Yakini cults within the monastery, and they would have a shrine there. And there's actual texts that talk about the local villagers coming and offering their children to stay for a temporary period of time in the monastery as a devotion to that Yakini. So this is probably a substitute for child sacrifice. So in the early days, they would have killed their children, but the Buddhists converted them all, so they don't kill them, they just leave them in the monastery for a period of time. Mulasarasi Vinaya goes into great detail, telling you all of the different allowances you have to make for these little kids who are in the monasteries. They cried in the evening and the Buddha said, okay, give them something to eat, and so on, it goes all these things. And it would seem reasonable that from time to time, the children would want to stay on in the monasteries, yeah? And so after they've been offered, maybe their parents come to go back, take them back, and they say, oh, Mum, can I stay on, or whatever? So they get left there, and then they would become known as the children of those Yakinis, yeah? And so I can't think of any other way to explain why so many of these monks are called the children of Yakinis. If it was one or two, you'd think it was coincidence, but it's actually nearly half of them are named after Yakinis. Putta means child, yeah, exactly. Yeah, Putta is a child.
So is Hariti only a name for Yakini?
Sorry?
Is, for example, Hariti only a
name for Yakini? I've never encountered it in any other case. It could be used, I mean, you know, it's common for goddesses' names to be used for people.
Well, are there any books about ordinary
Indian women at that time? There's quite a number of names, yeah. Again, if it was one or two, yes, of course you'd think it was that kind of coincidence because it's so many and because there are these explicit stories that talk about these things. See, for example, Kotiputta, to say that Kotiputta is the son of a Devi is not a... that's explicitly what it says in the story about him in here, that he said that he was the son of a local deity in the forest and these kinds of things. So it's quite strong evidence for this. So I think it's quite fascinating. Yeah. So, in any case, so what we can see is this link up. Now, what this did, this is really critical because what this showed was that the texts that we had from the Pali and the Sri Lankan text actually had some historical basis. Okay? Before this, nobody knew that. Okay? Nobody knew that these texts were anything other than just pure invention. Okay? And we read all the stories about yakas and so on, and we're thinking, is this real? What's going on here? But there is a historical basis to it. And this is the most concrete example of that. They went to... The Sri Lankans had no knowledge of these stupas. You know, here we are, we're Sanchi, yeah? Not in Sri Lanka. It's a language that they couldn't have read. It's inscriptions that were buried under, you know, under these ruins. And yet you find the same group of monks, not only the same names... but also, they are said to be. They are said to be the teachers of the Hemavata. Okay, so the teachers of the Himalayan region. Alright? So they're specifically said to be those teachers. So why are they, of course the question is, what are they doing down in Sanchi? So quite possibly they'd gone up to the Himalayan region, done their preaching and things like that. Either somehow their school became established down in Sanchi. Perhaps later in their life, one or more of them moved down there, or perhaps Dundubhisara Dayada, the heir of Dundubhisara, came back to Sanchi and they brought the relics from his teachers back with him and they put them in the stupa. So not quite sure how that happened, but in any case, the stupas are there.
Or they knew that that was where the Buddha's relics were and they decided that they wanted to die there or something.
Could well have done, if he's died on a pilgrimage or anything, yeah. Could be anything. So there's an excellent article, this fellow Willis wrote an excellent article discussing that, if you want some more detail. So, and that's a really solid finding. It's been in place for many, more than a century now, and it's never been disputed. Okay, so... Okay, so that's these guys. Then we have the elder Sonaka and the elder Uttara went to Suvarnabhumi. Okay, so obviously flew down into the Suvarnabhumi airport. Hopefully Thaksin's supporters weren't trying to close the thing down at the time. Suvarnabhumi is usually believed to be either southern Burma, of course the Burmese believe it to be Burma and the Thais believe it to be Thai. Scholars say it's uncertain, but most people think it's a lower Burmese Mon region. But it's quite disputed. Anyway, they went there and defeated this child-eating Rakshasi, ogress, who was devouring all the children born in the royal family. And so on. And so if you're familiar with Greek mythology, you know these kinds of things happen all the time, like Andromeda. It's kind of put out, she's going to be eaten by the sea monster and so on. Right, yeah. Yeah, to keep them happy. Yeah.
Okay. Is this the same story that her own child was taken by the Buddha to the teacher?
That's right, that's Hariti.
Yeah.
So yep.
That ritual is actually based on this story.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so it's still a living thing. You know, it's interesting how the text is here in the Pali, but I'm not aware of any particular, use of Hariti in terms of a modern day ritual. They have other devas in different parts of the place.
In the morning, then
So Sona Uttara went to Lower Myanmar or Thailand and converted everybody there. Interestingly enough, ordained 3,500 young men and 1,500 women. So this is the basic, this is the first text that talks about Buddhism in that period, early period of Buddhist history, and clearly mentions that there was bhikkhunis being ordained at that time in Lower Burma or Thailand. The particular episode is disputed. There's no archaeological evidence for Buddhism in Thailand or Lower Burma at this time. Okay, so this is still talking the time of Ashoka. So perhaps the historicity of that is not clear. And then finally, of course, the story of Mahinda, who went to Sri Lanka. And it's a well-attested tradition within Sri Lanka, and that Mahinda went to Sri Lanka is also mentioned in some of the northern scriptures as well. Okay, so this general pattern, you know, we can't confirm every detail of this, but the general pattern is very plausible, and what we can confirm from the archaeological record and by correlating the southern and northern scriptures does tend to confirm the picture that we get of the geographical dispersion. It's the introduction to the Samatapasadika. Yeah, it's just called here the inception of discipline and the Vinaya Nidana. Yeah, but this is the introduction to Samatapasadika. Okay. So what I'd like to have a look at briefly is just some of the texts that talk about the how the first schism happened and so on. So again, if you read Sects and Sectarianism, to have a look at my view of which one of these are actually plausible. But anyway, here's this treatise by Vasumitra, translated 3 times into Chinese and also translated into Tibetan, probably composed around the 2nd century CE, Vasumitra being probably of the Sarvastivadin, possibly, persuasion. But anyway, it seems to have... I think anyway, here has an account of the schisms. So just to read through, here's just a translation from Vasumitra. There's a conversation between Manjushri and the Buddha. And oh, he's a bodhisattva. So, okay. The first two schools will be the Mahasanghikas and the Staviras, which is just the Theras, the ancestor of the Theravadins and other schools. Within 100 years after Mahanirvana, a school will be formed called the Ekavyaharikas. Okay, and this means the one. These are offshoot of Mahasanghikas, and this is means the one mode of discourse. Okay, what that means is that they believe that everything the Buddha said was ultimately really, really, truly, really true. Okay? Okay? And they didn't admit that that he was sometimes would crack a joke, for example. Yeah? Or would sometimes talk in similes and things like that. Everything had the flavour of ultimate truth. And then 100 years after that was the Kukulikas. Again, these are all offshoots of the Mahasanghikas. Kukulikas, not really sure what they believed. Some people say that Kukula sounds like a word for glowing embers, and that they argued that the world is nothing more than a mass of absolute suffering without any pleasure in it whatsoever. Then there's the Bahu Shrutiyas, the much learned, and then the Chaitiyavadins, the ones who teach the doctrine or teach about Chaitiyas. Then you have these Purva Shailas and Uttara Shailas. These are two groups who were based in Andhra Pradesh, here, and the Shaila or Sela is a cliff. And so they were on one cliff and the other cliff. So you can imagine you had one monastery here and then another monastery on the other cliff over there. So that's what they were. They were the two monasteries on the opposite cliffs. They were actually branches of the Mahasanghika school, very close in doctrine. And they were down here in Andhra Pradesh. It seems, from the latest research, it seems that Nagarjuna stayed there and formulated some of his doctrines down there. It's also well established that the Sri Lankans had, Mahaviharavasins had a branch monastery in Andhra Pradesh. Okay? And in fact, one of the old commentaries that Buddhaghosa used, but doesn't exist anymore, was called the Andhra Commentary. Okay? So they were a distinct community related to the Mahaviharavasins, i.e. the Theravadins. This was the major trade route. Okay? So they were in direct competition with these guys, the Uttara Shailas and Upara Shailas and Apurva Shailas. So they many doctrinal arguments recorded between them. Okay, so all these Mahasanghika groups. And then from the Staviras were formed 11 schools. 100 years after, there was another called the Sarvastivadins. So each kind of conventionally said to arise after 100 years. Sarvastivadins. And then the Haimavatas, we've already met them. They were up in the Himalayan region, and that was that group of 5 monks, presumably, who started the Haimavata. Another group, the Vatsiputriyas, sons of the calf, perhaps. But notice that Vatsiputriya is actually the same, one of the names we have here, Vatsya, Vatsiputra. Interesting. So this was the Puglavadin school. So Vatsiputra was the founder of the Puglavadin school. Dharmottariyas, somewhat dubious school. And the Bhadrayaniyas, the excellent vehicles. And the Samitiyas. These are mostly branches of the Puglavadin school. Here's the Shanagarika as the six cities school. Presumably they had branches in six cities. And then another one. Someone can give a translation. Anyway. Mahishasikas. Okay. And then the Dharmaguptas, Tamuda, Kashyapiyas. These are very closely related, Mahishasikas, Dharmaguptas, Kashyapiyas, very similar to the Theravadins. And then the Sarvantikas were a reform school based on the Sarvastivadins. So when we give our modern information about the schools, this is one of the very important root texts. And down here, a little bit further, it gives the actual story of the schism. Okay? And so here's the story of the schism. According to Vasumitra, 116 years after the Nirvana of the Buddha, in a city called Pataliputta, there's a king called Ashoka who shall gather the whole of Jambudvipa as his empire. In his time, the division of the great congregation into schools shall begin. There shall arise a bhikkhu called Nun, and another called Iun. These names are different in the different versions. They shall assert the necessity of teaching five propositions as a basis for religious instruction. The 5 points are these. So remember I mentioned the 5 theses. So these are the 5 theses. This one is mistranslated. Ignorance, doubt, words according to religious formula, to obtain reason. That's a very bad translation of these things. What they are is, first one is parupahara, which means conveyance by another. This is originally given in a verse. This is why it's so terse and so difficult to translate. It's a particular verse, and the verse is modelled. Now this comes back to that question of schism that we mentioned before. In all of the vinayas, in the Parimokkha, at the end of it, the schools recite what they call the Ovada Parimokkha. Yeah? Sabba papasa akaranam kusala supasampadasa chitta pariyodapanam etam buddhana sasanam. Not to do any evil, to do what is good, purify the mind, this is the Buddha's dispensation. So every vinaya, except for the Pali, interestingly enough, but every other vinaya has these verses at the end of it. And they must have been recited from a very early age at the Parimokkha by the bhikkhus in the Parimokkha. Right? Fair enough. Now this verse, when we try to reconstruct this from the various Chinese and Pali sources, probably it has a very much similar rhythmic structure and almost is exactly the same structure as some of the verses from the Ovada Parimokkha. Right? So in other words, this verse has been constructed to sound like and to be the same form as the verse which was actually recited at the Upasita, but it contains the specific doctrines of the Mahasanghika. So this is why this was alleged to, one of the reasons why this was alleged to have been a schism, because it was actually recited at the Upasita, or was in that form, you see? So this is why it's quite interesting. But the first one, parupahara, literally means conveyance by another, okay? Now that doesn't necessarily tell us a whole lot about what it means, right? But what it actually means is that the devas of Mara's retinue can convey semen in a dream to an arahant. Yeah? To make him feel, to give him doubts and to make him fall away from his attainment, or at least to cause doubt in others. That didn't come up actually in the debate. Yeah. Now, but you might think that that's strange, right? I might think that that's strange, right? But the interesting thing about it is that exactly the same thing is found in the Malleus Maleficarum. Which, exactly? Yeah?
Greek.
Don't know Malleus Maleficarum. You guys don't know that. Malleus Maleficarum, the witch's hammer. By the two Dominican priests who wrote this handbook on how to crush witches, how to identify witches and how to crush them, how do you know what's an incubi and a succubi and all of these things, Malleus Maleficarum. And one of the things he has there is that in order to create doubts in people, that the incubi and succubi will convey semen in a dream to pure people of pure heart in order to create doubt in them. Now, I find that quite extraordinary coincidence, if such it is. But anyway, so this was one of the issues. Ignorance means...
And
No, it's just... it's the Chinese, you know, the original Indic was Parupahara, which literally means para means another, upa means close, hara means bring. And so they translate that in various ways into Chinese, and he's tried to bring it into English. But you can only really understand it by referring to the original Pali and looking at the background stories. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Except that it wasn't Mahadeva. The whole thing about Mahadeva arose 500 years later, or much later.
This is from Vasumitra.
This is a text by Vasumitra. It's presented as if it's a sutra, but it's a text by Vasumitra about 2nd century AD. Yeah? Mahadeva is brought in much later into this story. Okay? And he's only in the translations of Vasumitra, unfortunately, he's only mentioned in the last one of that, which was the one by Xuan Zang. He did the latest translation into Chinese, and that one mentions Mahadeva. Yeah? But of course, because Xuan Zang was such an influential translator, that's the one all the Chinese read from then on. So they all assumed that Mahadeva was the first person involved here. Yeah? But actually, none of the earlier translations, and nor does the Tibetan translation mention Mahadeva at all. As you can see here, it mentions the names of the people involved, and there's nothing to do with Mahadeva. Yeah? So that's a mistake that was introduced later into the tradition. Yeah? It actually stems originally from the Sarvastivadin commentary. So the 5 points, Parupahara, second one, ignorance means an arahant can be ignorant about certain things. For example, how do you get to what Buddha Dhamma? An arahant might not know that. An arahant might have doubt about certain things. Is this the way to what Buddha Dhamma or not? Are we going to what Buddha Dhamma tomorrow? Yeah? So of course you see these are things which, you know, it's hard to say, you know, really, which words according to the correct, to the religious formula. No, that's not, what's that one is? Oh, one can be led by another. Okay? So an arahant can be led by another. That means that they can gain information from another. Again, it's a similar kind of thing. There are certain things which they know or don't know. And so the debate, of course, the traditional or the Theravadan point of view would be that, of course, an arahant can have ignorance or doubt or can be taught by another about things that weren't essential to the Dhamma, but things that were essential to the Dhamma, then they would know for themselves. All right? So this one's really just a matter of just how you define the debates. And this last one, to obtain reason, that's got nothing to do with it. The last one is that one can give arise to the path by crying out, Aho Dukkhang! Aho Dukkhang! Okay, and so that's...
What does that mean?
Aho suffering. Aho means aho. Oh, yeah, suffering.
Just
that Ku Tsai, Ku Tsai.
Ku
Tsai. Ku Tsai. Ku Tsai. Ku Tsai.
Yeah.
If that doesn't work,
how do you think?
It's living to suffering.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So what you have here in Vasumitra, you just have the bare mention of these things. It was from a consideration of these questions that the first two schools arose, that is, Mahasanghikas and Staviras. So that's Vasumitra. Now, the Pali tradition, as we'll see in a minute, ascribes the schism to different reasons. Okay, but these 5 points are actually discussed in the Pali scriptures very prominently in this book, which is the Katavattu, translated as the points of controversy. Okay? So clearly there's a common basis between the Pali source and Vasumitra and other northern sources. The Pali source doesn't explicitly say that the first schism was due to these disputes. Alright? So that's one problem. If you want to look at the background story, the context to that is actually here, and it's all translated here in the delightfully Oedipal story of Mahadeva. Now I mentioned that Mahadeva is I think it's in here. Mahadeva is a much, this is a much later story. Okay, so this is from a much later text. In the past, there was a merchant of Mathura, and he had a beautiful young wife who gave birth to a son. His face was lovely, so they called him Mahadeva. Notice the, it's in Mathura, which is significant. They called him Mahadeva. Not long afterwards, the merchant took much wealth and went to a far country. There he engaged in trade for a long time without returning. When the son grew up, he had indecent relations with his mother. Afterwards, hearing that his father was returning, his mind grew afraid. With his mother, he formed a plan, then killed his father. Right? Thus, he committed one anantarika sin. Now, of course, the Greeks had been in Western India for hundreds of years by this time. There are inscriptions, for example, of depicting the characters on the from the Trojan War in northwestern India. So whether there's an influence from Oedipus here is uncertain. That act gradually became known. So taking his mother, they prepared. So there he committed one anantarika sin. So this is the karma which means you immediately go to hell, right? Next life, you're definitely going to hell. So killing his father is one of them. Taking his mother, he would flee and hide in Pataliputta. They came across an arahant bhikkhu who had previously made offerings to in his own country. He was afraid his act would be revealed, so he made a plan and killed that bhikkhu. Right? So it's the second anantarika. So it's the third one. Killed an arahant. No, Angulimala's already a serial killer, but he didn't do the anantarika sins. Yeah? His mind became sad and worried. Later, he saw his mother having intercourse with someone else. Right, so it's getting pretty sorted, right? He's sleeping with his mum. His mum goes and cheats on him. He's angry. He said, "For your sake, I've already committed two grave sins. We've moved to another country and still find no peace. Now you've given me up and pleasure yourself with another man. How can I endure such filthy deeds from you?" Therefore, in the same way, he killed his mother. Thus, he committed a third anantarika sin. But there was no cutting off of the power of wholesome roots for that reason. So this is kind of interesting. The text is saying, yeah, he's still got wholesome roots there. So he still became gravely sorrowful and could not sleep at peace, thinking, how can one eradicate one's own grave sins? He heard it rumoured that the ascetic sons of the Sakyans taught a Dhamma for the eradication of past sins, and he went to the Kukutarama monastery in Pataliputta, the main monastery in Pataliputta, also mentioned in the Pali texts. This, by the way, I should mention, this is from the large Mahavibhasha, a text of the Sarvastivadins, composed somewhat after, a little bit after Vasumitra's text we had there, second or third century following the fourth or the council in Kashmir. Then he said, okay, went to Kukut, and outside the gates he saw a bhikkhu practicing walking meditation, chanting the following verse: "If a man commits a heavy sin by doing good, he makes it end. Then that man lights up the world as the moon emerges from the clouds." When he heard this, his heart leapt for joy, knowing that by refuge in the Buddha's religion, he would certainly end that sin. So then he went, asked for the going forth, and the monk gave him the going forth without questioning carefully. Of course, this is the questions that you're supposed to give before the ordination. Interesting that it suggests that they weren't always asked. Mahadeva was intelligent. Not long after going forth, he could recite from memory the entire Tripitaka in its letter and meaning. His speech was clever and skillful, so he was able to instruct. Everyone in Pataliputta, without exception, took him as his guide. The king heard him, frequently summoned him within the palace and made offerings to him and asked for Dhamma instruction. After leaving there, he went to stay in the monastery. Because of crooked thinking in a dream, he emitted impurity. Oh dear. However, previously he had been praised as an arahant. He asked one of his disciples to wash his soiled robe. The disciple said, "An arahant has already eliminated all asavas, it's like the outflows. So how can the teacher now still allow this to happen?" Mahadeva replied, "This is the troublemaking of Mara Deva Putta. You should not think it strange. There are in brief two kinds of omission of asavas. The first is the defilements. The second is physical impurity. The arahant has no defilement of asavas, but even they cannot avoid omitting the asavas of impurities. For what reason, though an arahant has ended all defilements, how could they not have substances such as tears, spittle, and so on? Moreover, all Mara Deva Puttas are constantly jealous and hating Buddhism. When they see someone practicing their good, they therefore approach to destroy them. They will even do this for arahants, which is why I omitted impurity. This is what happens, and now you should not have any cause for doubting." All right? So this is Mahadeva's the arising of the first wrong view. So then he gave these teachings, and his disciples said, all arahants have enlightenment wisdom. Okay, he wished to instruct his disciples to a delighting personal attachment to him. He gave them teaching, and his disciples said, arahants all have enlightenment wisdom. How can we not know ourselves? And he replied thus, all arahants also have ignorance. What seems to be happening, the text is not entirely clear, but what seems to be happening is that he was telling his disciples that they're all enlightened. Okay? And that they said, well, hang on, shouldn't we know for ourselves that we're enlightened? And so they asked him, and he said, no, so they don't necessarily know, arahants don't necessarily know whether they're enlightened. So a similar thing about the tendency to doubt and the noble being led by another. So then the other interesting one, so Mahadeva, even though he'd committed a host of crimes, had not cut off and stopped all previous wholesome routes. Afterwards, alone in the middle of the night, his sin weighed heavily, thinking, in what place will I experience all that severe suffering? Depressed and afraid, he frequently cried out, oh, what suffering! Oh, what suffering! Oh, Dukkham! His attendant disciple heard the cry and was amazed. In the morning, he visited and questioned, how are you these days? Mahadeva said, I'm extremely blissful. And the disciple continued to question, last night, did you cry out, oh, what suffering? He said, oh, yes, I shouted the noble path. You should not think this is strange. It is said that if one does not, with complete sincerity, invoke suffering, summing it with one's whole life, then the noble paths will not manifest. That is why last night I frequently cried out, oh, what suffering, oh, what suffering. Okay? So this is giving a story of the arising of the wrong views. And even though it's obviously, very... you know, trying to destroy his character as badly as they possibly can. Nevertheless, it does give a not unreasonable context for the arising of many of those things. So this is the same verse we had before. Another conveys impurity and ignorance, doubt he learns from another. The path is caused by the utterance of a sound that is called the Buddha's true dispensation. And so then it says that Mahadeva then recited that in the Upasita. Okay, and then they said, only a fool would make such a statement. And they cried out, this is not in the Tripitaka. And then they recomposed the verse. Another conveys impurity, ignorance, doubt. He learns from another. The path is caused by the utterance of a sound. What you say is not the Buddha's dispensation. Then the whole night was full of rowdy arguments. Until finally, in the morning, factions emerged. Okay, so blah, 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 went out. No, this is from Sarvastivadin scripta, from the great Sarvastivadin commentary they call the Mahavi Bhasha, composed in Kashmir about 2nd century. Yeah, it's a great story. So then the king mediates and they have a schism. The noble faction, though many in years, were few in number. Mahadeva's faction, though few in years, were many in number. That's what it says. And then they kept on arguing, and then emerged the Staviras and the Mahasanghikas. Now, then goes on to tell more interesting stories. It says, knowing that the community was rebellious, all the noble ones, right, so all the enlightened monks, left the Kukadarama monastery and wanted to go elsewhere. When their ministers told the king was angry, this is Ashoka, and commanded his ministers, take them down to the Ganges, and put them in a broken boat and float them in midstream to drown. Then we'll find out who is a noble one and who is an ordinary person. All right? So he's really giving them the test. Again, interesting how this is... I mean, if you've seen...
fun-loving Buddhist people.
If you've seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, yeah? That's exactly how they tested for witches, isn't it? Yeah?
If she's lighter than a duck...
Exactly, they did, and they did in real life in India as well. It's mentioned elsewhere, yeah. So this is ministers carried out the king's wishes and put it into effect. Then all those noble ones arose with psychic powers, just like a king goose flying in the air, and they left. Returning, they used their psychic power to grab those in the boats who they'd left the Kukadarama monastery with and who did not have psychic powers. Okay? Displaying many miracles, they manifested in various forms and they voyaged through the sky to the northwest and left. That's style. Yeah?
It's interesting how they...
Oh, absolutely.
Fix the cave in, doesn't it? It's interesting how they mentioned that not all of them have psychic powers. Usually in the stories, it's like, especially the short ones, it's like 50,000 arms flying through the air at the same time. You know, it's like
quite modest, actually.
Well, this is plausible. It's like there was actually some without psychic powers in the boats.
Not the blokes. Yeah, it doesn't say that the Sikhs were involved in that. I think they were too nice to be involved with the schisms. That's my feeling. When the king heard and saw this, he was deeply regretful. He fainted and fell down on the ground. They sprinkled him with water, and only then did he regain his senses. Quickly, he sent scouts. I don't know what the scouts were doing. He sent the girl's eyes to follow the arahants where they went. A minister returned, having found out they were staying in Kashmir. But the Sangha was asked to return. All refused the insistent request. The king then gave away all of Kashmir. Okay, so Ashoka gave Kashmir to the Sangha, establishing a monastery for the noble ones to stay. Each monastery was named after the various altered forms that each had previously manifested with fleeing. It was said that there were 500 pigeon monasteries. Yeah? So you can see how this story would have arisen. Now, you know, maybe there was a custom for some reason in Kashmir to name the monasteries after birds of some kind, and so the story arose to explain that. He sent a messenger with much wealth to organize for their material needs and offerings. Because of this, that land up to the present has had many noble beings upholding the Buddha's Dhamma, which has been handed down from then until now and is still flourishing. Now again, notice the connection with the Pali text, which also says when Majandika went to Kashmir that it became flourishing and very prosperous in the Dhamma up to the present time. Now, of course, what this is doing, remember, this is a Sarvastivadin text composed by the Vaibhashika Sarvastivadins in Kashmir, okay, under the auspices of King Kanishka, who was kind of like a little Ashoka in the northwest of India. So what it's doing is it's authorizing their school as being established by the real, authentic arahants. Similar way to, he said, Moggaliputta in the Pali text said that Buddha's dispensation would be established in the border regions. Yeah? So he had this sort of move to authenticate one's own school by creating a story which was actually the real arahants. They're the ones who established our branch of Buddhism in Kashmir. And then afterwards kept on going to the Kukadarama monastery, and then there was this prediction that he was going to die, and Mahadeva faked his prediction. A soothsayer predicted that he was going to die for him, and then he went around saying he was going to die so that he could. Then when the seventh day was predicted, his life came to an end. The king and all the citizens were full of grief and regret. They brought fragrant firewood together with many oils, flowers and offerings. They piled them in one place to burn them. But when they brought the fire there, it went out. Many times they tried in different ways, but just could not make it burn. Okay? Just like when the Buddha's funeral pyre, they couldn't burn. It is said that a soothsayer said to the people, "This will not burn with these good quality cremation materials. We should use dog shit and smear food." After following this advice, the fire immediately blazed up. It instantly burnt up and became ashes. A strong wind blew up and scattered the remains.
If you've ever been to Burma, Sri Lanka, you know that won't take too long. There's lots of packs of wild dogs everywhere.
So that's Mahadeva, obviously not a favourite of the Buddhist tradition. No, this is a much later legend. Okay, so this is like 2nd or 3rd century AD, talking about a schism that happened 500 years before. Yeah? Now, the actual account of the five points seems to me reasonably reasonable. Yeah? Something like that may well have happened, you know, in that general sense, but obviously the story of Mahadeva itself is so lurid, one finds it difficult to accept that somebody like that could have actually established a school of Buddhism. But the interesting things about it, again, to come back to this question of a schism. Now, you would think this particular text is going, it's pulling out all the stops, right? It's making Mahadeva be as bad as possible, all right? It could hardly do anything worse, right? And yet, it accuses him of committing the Anantarika karma for killing his mother, another Anantarika karma for killing his father, another Anantarika karma for killing an arahant, okay? And so there are two remaining. One is maliciously shedding the blood of a Buddha, obviously he couldn't do, and the fifth one is causing schism in the Sangha, all right? And he's not accused of that.
Strange.
Even in this text, which is pulling out all stops to say that he was the worst possible, he's not accused of that. So this, I think, is one of the reasons for saying that this schism was not, or this split was not a formal schism in the Vinaya sense. And even here, they don't try to argue that.
And is that because he was not doing that out of a lie maliciously, but because he actually believed what he was saying was true? Is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily, but it doesn't fulfill the actual requirements, legal requirements for a schism. Yeah? They actually held the Upposatha together. They held the Upposatha together with the other monks, but then when he came for him to give a Dhamma talk, they all ended up breaking up and having an argument. So they didn't actually complete a separate Upposatha within the same Sema.
That's what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah? So this is why the legal definition of schism is quite different from what we would think of as being like a split in the Sangha. Obviously the Sangha was split, but they didn't actually, fighting, monks brawling in the Upposatha hall is not a problem, okay?
It's the same as that picture with the Buddha when he turns up to that place where the monks are fighting with each other, cutting each other with verbal daggers.
Yeah.
Because he just goes, oh yeah, well, whatever, I'm out of here, you don't listen.
Yeah.
And he just allows them to keep on fighting. Mm. And that's, there's no mention of schism there either.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's certainly moving towards the schism, but it's a different kind
of thing. Have you had the meditators versus the Vinaya experts or something?
Okay, so this is the story of Mahadeva, as accepted and very famous. I mean, you can see what a terrific story, eh? But not hugely plausible, in my opinion. Now, here's another version of things from the Dipawangsa. Don't have a translation here. So Dipawangsa composed in Sri Lanka, 3rd or 4th century AD, a bit later than Vasumitra. Absolutely abysmal Pali, and I'm sure that there's no connection here, but also probably composed by bhikkhunis, right? So possibly the only work in Pali actually from the old times composed by bhikkhunis from the internal evidence of the text. So here is, where are we? Okay. Notice here, Gantwana Kukuta Rama, having gone to the Kukuta Rama, Kukuta Monastery in Pataliputra, the same monastery talked about in the story of Mahadeva. Yeah? It's important to notice this because the question, these are all, you know, this is, they're all talking about the same monasteries, the same monks, the same names are appearing. Yeah? So there's clearly not a schism already at that time. This is talking about how the thing, schism arose. Where are we now? Okay, so this is the account of the Second Council, and then it says, after 8 months, which is a long time, the Second Council was finished. All right? That's the end of the Second Council, and notice this, ti, meaning end of section. Right? So this is, my argument is that this next section here is clearly a textual interpolation, doesn't have anything to do with the Second Council. But it's on this basis, this textual basis, that everyone says that the schism happened after the Second Council, blah, 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 all these things. So have a look at that. But there's a T, it says end of section. This is an interpolation. It does, nitita. That's true. But that's not so critical because that's just a mark by an editor. So that doesn't really mean anything. What's more relevant is if you look here, okay, there, and this is the account of the schisms. We'll come back to that in a moment. And all at the end of that full account of the schisms, Acharya Kula Bhedam, the teachers' families split, is finished. That's the word for the schisms. And the next verse, that's just a textual note, the next verse, and in the future, in 118 years, there arises, or there is born that bhikkhu, or there appears that bhikkhu who is a good monk, and then it goes on to talk, and his name is Mogali Puttatissa. Okay? So this is the monk we mentioned as being the leader of the third council. Okay? So notice that in the Pali chronology, the third council happened 118 years after the second council. Alright? So here it's saying 118 years in the future happened this monk who appeared and formed the third council. So it's obviously talking from the end of the second council. Yeah? It's saying now 118 years in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And yet we've had in between those two bits, we've had this whole thing talking about the emergence of all the schools and the schisms and things mm-hmm. like that. So clearly that bit there belongs up here at the end of the second council. And then it should say, and then in the future, and here the second council is finished, and then 118 years in the future there appeared this monk Mogali Puttatissa, and then he caused the third council. Okay?
So this is how many years after the third council?
This is, if there's about third or fourth century, so it'd be roughly 500 years. Yeah. Based on earlier sources. But the deeper ones is very, very patchwork. And what they compile things from various different, it'll have like two or three versions of the same events just sort of clunked in there in different places with no attempt to edit them and put them together in a proper way. So that editing job is what we call the Mahavamsa. That took the deeper Vamsa, expanded it and put it all together, and the Mahavamsa got used. This is very raw. It's like raw cut and paste from different sources. Okay, so this is the story then, after the Second Council, the story of what happened. Then, having got rid of those evil bhikkhus by the terrors, the elders, those evil Bajiputtika bhikkhus, formed another faction, which was teachers of what is not Dhamma, and had many people. And then Dasa Sahasa, 10,000 of them having gathered, they made a recitation of the Dhamma, and that recitation is called the Mahasangiti, the Great Recitation. And in this text, Mahasangiti is used as a synonym for Mahasangika. Okay. And those Mahasangitika bhikkhus, Mahasangikas, went against the grain and made against the grain of the sasana. Having broken the mula, the original recitation, they made another recitation. And then they recited or collected other suttas that they composed. They made another, they broke the Dhamma up and they broke the Vinaya and the five Nikayas. Those things which were taught in a way of speaking, and those which were taught, how do you say that, definitively. So those which were taught metaphorically, perhaps, and those taught definitively. Remember I mentioned one of the schools, Mahasangika schools, was the one statement school. They said that everything the Buddha said was meant definitively and literally. Eka Vyaharika. So this is talking about that same question, is a matter of interpretation of the scriptures. Nitatang, and what is of definitive meaning and what is requiring explanation, those monks did not understand. Okay? And then they recited some things and then they put some things aside. And then they mixed up the grammar and destroyed much meaning. Chadevana Ekidesan.
That's funny, coming from this text.
Exactly, this is the irony of it. Yeah?
They've got it all wrong, but they've got the paragraphs wrong in this one.
Yeah. And it goes on in a similar meaning that they got rid of many profound suttas and vinaya, and then they may have composed others. And the interesting thing here, what they got rid of, okay, what they got rid of, Visajivana, was the Parivara. Okay? Now Parivara is the late Sinhalese addition to the Vinaya. It's the last book in the Pali Vinaya, and it's clearly a later addition. Okay, they got rid of the six books of the Abhidhamma. Okay, so this is the six books except for the Katavattu, this one, which was composed later. All right, this is a book of controversies. Okay, so they got rid of the six. They got rid of the Patisambhida, which again is a late book in the Kuddhika Nikaya. The Nidesa, late commentaries on the Suttanipata. Certain of the Jatakas, okay, they got rid of. Now, I'm looking at that and thinking, well,
well done.
That this is a very precise analysis of the late additions to the Pali Canon, and they have got rid of precisely those things which they probably should have got rid of, or at least they've identified clearly those texts which were late. Okay. Now this one here, they're talking about the grammar, again, the nouns, genders, and different grammatical terms, prakara, I can't remember prakara in grammatical sense. The natural cases and so on were all destroyed, so they couldn't get their grammar right. Okay? And I think that what's going on here is because if we look at all of the Mahasanghika texts, right, that we have, all of them are written in what we call Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit. And any Pali scholar who would look at Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit were thinking, these guys just can't get their grammar right. And that's what the Western scholars thought for decades. These people don't know Sanskrit, they get their nouns wrong, they get their genders wrong, they mix up because it's a very difficult dialect. So what I think this is a criticism of Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit from a Pali perspective. Remembering that the Mahasanghikas, as I said, were here, yeah, in Andhra Pradesh, and so were the Mahaviharans. Okay, so what I think this particular text is a record of disputes between these two groups, hundreds of years after the first schism, 500 years after the first schism. Okay, which was later backdated to the schism itself. Of course, all of these things are completely anachronistic in the context. We know all of these books were composed later than the time of Ashoka, right? We know that Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit and the use of different dialects for Buddhism, you know, wouldn't have emerged at that early period yet in the time of Ashoka. They're all still living in the same region, yeah? They're all living in Pataliputta. Mm-hmm. Why would they have different dialects? But, of course, once they've spread out, then, of course, they did develop different dialects. So everything about this suggests that it was dated much later, and it's actually a record of a much later dispute between the Mahaviharavasins of Sri Lanka and the Mahasanghikas, probably, of Andhra Pradesh. Okay. That's another whole interesting thing, but because it talks about bhikkhunis a lot, it gives almost as much space or about as much space to bhikkhunis as it does to bhikkhus, and it actually even goes into a lot of details, personal details, and actually mentions that some of the bhikkhunis were compilers of histories. No?
Definitely not written by bhikkhus.
Yeah, so there's actually quite strong internal evidence for that. Yeah. So even though the Pali is bad, but what this kind of emerged at the period, this was like almost the first product of the resurgence of Pali composition in Sri Lanka, 3rd or 4th century. And it's then following that then the great Pali works, the next generation or two, were written, the great Pali commentaries and the Mahavamsa and so on were composed. So this is like this is where they started to actually compose in the Pali language. Previously they'd composed in the Sinhala.
Well, it makes sense about too, if it's poorly written.
The canon,
yes.
A few hundred years later, that was about 20 BC. This is about. Yep.
I think that the bhikkhunis of the time probably wouldn't have been highly educated or anything like that.
Well, I mean, they must be fairly educated. Remembering that Pali is the second language for them.
Sinhalese and the Pali would have been fairly close.
Similar, but still the second language. Okay, so the Mahasanghitis were the leaders in the schisms, and then after them many other schisms came about. And in later times you had the Gokulika, similar to the Kukulika we had in Vasumitra. Eka Vyohari is the Eka Vyoharikas. It's the same. And the Gokulika broke into two. The Bahasutika we also had, Bahasutriya. Panyati, I'm not quite sure what that is, but that's possibly related to these guys, but anyway. The Chetiyavada we also had, and the, there's the five, Punavadi. Yeah, it doesn't mention the Aparaselas, but they're found elsewhere in Pali. Then the, then it repeats this thing about them breaking up the texts and getting rid of mixing up things and so on. And then from then the pure Theravada then broke up into more schisms, the Mahinshasikas, the Mahishasikas, the Vajiputikas, which is, this is not the Vajiputikas of the Second Council, this is actually the Vatsiputriyas of the, who are actually the Pugalavadins, that name isn't used here. They broke up into four, the Samitis, Chanagarika, Padayanika, and Dhammottariya. These are the branches of the Pugalavadin school. Mahishasika is broken into two, Sarvastivada and Dharmaguptaka. Okay? That's probably not accurate, but anyway. Sabbativagans and Kashapiyas, Sankantikas. This one's a bit doubtful. Possibly it's the Sautrantikas, or the Suttavada is the Sautrantikas. Okay, and broke up. So you can see that even though the what you can see is the crucial thing about all these accounts is that the origin story of the schism is completely different. Right? The story we had in Vasumitra and Vaidbhashavata is very similar. The thief wife's version is utterly different. There's no common ground at all. But the actual schools and the list of schools is pretty much similar. Yeah? So my explanation for that is that these lists were written, say, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, and the lists of schools are actually an accurate description of the schools that existed in that time. But the description of the schisms was talking about an event many hundreds of years before, and they didn't have accurate information about that. So they basically invented myths to justify their own particular position. So this is, then it then talks about how they've all schismed off, and then it says, now the 17 are schismatic. And one school is non-schismatic. Okay? And then taking all of them together, there's 18. Okay? Okay, so the Theravada, okay, is like a great banyan tree. Okay? Which is neither deficient, anuna, nor an adhika, nor excessive, contains the entirety of the Buddha's dispensation. Okay? The other schools, Vadasesika, arose like thorns on the tree. Okay? So this is the Theravadan position. And down here it goes on, it mentions a few others down here emerging. The Hemavatika, we also met before, the Jagirika Siddhata, Pubra Aparasela, these are the ones in Andhra Pradesh. There. Alright. So this is the Deepamasa's version. Now, this particular little reddish book is a terrific read and is an extraordinary work. The Life of the Buddha in His Early History of His Order. The Life of the Buddha and the Early History of His Order by Rockhill, translated from the Tibetan Nirdesarasivada Vinaya in 18 something anyway. Still no other major translations from the Tibetan Vinaya after more than 100 years. 1884. And it's got a summary of the life of the Buddha from the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, so excellent there. But it also has some later stories from Tibet and so on. That are called, yeah, Woodville Rockhill. I don't know, an English scholar or something. Yeah. Yeah, they went up to. Yeah. So, what he, at the end of this, he gives a treatise by a fellow called Bhavya, or Bhavaviveka, and this treatise is written about 6th century, so later than the ones that we have so far. And this particular treatise, interestingly enough, compiles a number of different accounts of the schism. Right? It doesn't just have his own one, but he has about 3 or 4 accounts, right, which you can all read about them, and it has all the different versions and blah, blah, blah. So the interesting one is, and it gives some explanation as to why they're all called this and what their main doctrines were and so on. But in Bhavya 3, I won't go into detail on this one, because anyway, you can have a look in. Have a look in that if you're interested to look in some more details. But it's interesting that, you know, that was, you know, that tendency, see that different tendency, which you find in the Tibetan and also Chinese texts, which was to gather the materials from all the different sources and preserve them all side by side and then maybe discuss which one they preserved. Whereas the tendency in the Pali scriptures, which you can see, is to say, this is it, neither deficient nor excessive. Yeah? Everything else, this is the complete Buddhasasana, everything else is thorns on the tree. Yeah, so that very different kind of ideology. And just to one last thing, I'll just put in here. This is the this is this Shariputta Paripritta, which we've got an incomplete translation, which I was working on with Ayasama. It's a bit inconvenient for visual viewing, but thank you. How do you do that? Column? Doesn't do anything. So this is a very, very rough translation I was working on with Ayasama, which I'd like to finish sometime. This is the Shariputta Paripritta, and if everyone could just say that after me 5 times quickly without taking a breath. Yeah. The questions to Shariputta. And this is a Mahasanghika text composed about 1st or 2nd century. Okay, it's phrased as if it was a sutta. Obviously it's not a genuine sutta, but it's a phrase as if it's a sutta, the Buddha talking to Sariputta, and he's asking various questions, and then he gets on to asking the questions about the schisms, various questions about vinaya matters, allowances of so on. Are these question marks? This is probably, yeah, let me see if I can find it. Now this is an interesting one here. It talks about this one here. Sariputta said, why is it Tathagata's true Dhamma scattered like this in such a short time? Having thus lost the original character, how can we say that we respectfully follow? The Buddha said, the Mahasanghika have the unadulterated character. The other schools add some dew. Right? The day, this is a difficult text to translate, and this is very rough. The deities drink the dew, but drinking the dew, they discard the water. Humans drink both the dew and the water. Sometimes they get rid of illness, sometimes they fall ill. Yeah? The readers and reciters of the vineyards of other schools are also like this. Very wise people know which one to accept and which one to discard, but fools cannot discriminate. Okay? So this is the Mahasanghika position, is that, well, our teaching is really right and pure. All of the other schools have got the real thing in there, but they've also mixed it up with other things. So if you're wise, you can learn to discriminate and find your way around. But if you're not, then you won't and you'll get lost. Okay? So that's quite a different attitude to the schools than we find in the Pali one. Huh? So this is quite interesting. And I think I actually have... I think the other one is there. Yes. No, no, but one of the things that I found was that the first one is obviously to do with the idea of having a wet dream, and that there is a discussion about that in the Mahasanghika Vinaya, which seems to suggest that they accepted that point. So I think that they're probably quite likely that the five thesis was in fact accepted by the Mahasanghika. Just having a look in here, I think the actual bit is translated somewhere else. I ended up translating this because yeah, existing work on the Sariputta Paripitcha has been very unreliable. Excuse me. This is some reason it keeps on opening all the wrong format and can't change it back. Yeah. So this is a rough translation of this time of the schisms. I didn't. Okay, so it talks about from the time of Kassapa. Kassapa hands over dispensation to Ananda. Ananda hands over to Madhyandika. We already met Madhyandika, yeah? The disciple who took the Buddhism up to Sarvastivada, up to Kashmir. No, it's Mahasanghika Sutta. Yeah? Madhyandika will hand it over to Shanavasin. And Shanavasin is one of the leaders at the Second Council, mentioned in all the vineyards as being a leader at the Second Council. Yeah. Yeah. Very good, Annie. That's very sharp. Exactly, yeah. There's chronological confusion. Yeah. Madhyandika was probably later, but in the northern sources he's typically said to have been at this earlier time. That's a chronological confusion, yeah. Shanakavasin was the saint of Mathura and founder of the great monastery, Urumunda Monastery in Mathura. And Shanavasin handed over to Upagupta. So notice that this is the classic five masters of the law presented in all of the northern scriptures, and Shanakavasin and Upagupta. Again, one of the critical things that I emphasise in sects and sectarianism, these guys, Shanakavasin and Upagupta, were the local saints of Mathura, and they established a monastery in Mathura called in Mathura up here. Himatura here, which the Buddha said was full of dogs and yakas and so on. They established a forest monastery there, which was said to be the best place for meditation in all of India, with Urumunda on the Yamuna River. Now, when Moggaliputta, okay, who according to the Theravadin scriptures was the leader at the Third Council, when he thought that the politics was getting a bit too heated down here, and he wanted to go away and have a bit of a retreat, that's where he went. Okay, so he went to the monastery of Shanakavasin and Upagupta for retreat and stayed there for several years in meditation. Okay, then he was called back by King Ashoka and travelled on boat back to Pataliputta to form the Third Council and to resolve the disputes in the Sangha, according to the Theravadin version. And so not merely is he closely associated with Mathura and with Upagupta and Shanakavasin, but it's the spiritual charisma and power which he got from his period of retreat in the forest monastery there. That's what gave him the authority to be able to take the leadership role in the Sangha and to resolve the disputes in the Sangha. So all of these things revolve around Mathura. The Theravadan sources is very clear and very important. And also Mathura was probably the home of the Mulasarvasivadins. Okay, so the Tibetan Vinaya tradition probably began in Mathura. Right? It's very important for many reasons. And possibly, because of this mention of Upagupta, possibly the Shariputra Paribrichha was composed in Mathura. Okay, after Upagupta, there's a Mauryan wheel-turning king. It's obviously Ashoka, upholder of the Sutta Vinaya. His grandson was called Pushyamitra. Okay, so he succeeded to the throne. Pushyamitra was, that's supposed to be an insert there, actually. He was supposed to be a Brahmanical king who persecuted Buddhism. Alright? So he was the grandson of Ashoka. And this tells that story. I've missed that bit out of the translation there. That was supposed to be inserted from another source. Then later on, there was another king who was very good. And he re-established the Sasana at that time. So we're now talking like the great-grandson of Ashoka. Okay, so you're talking maybe 100 BC or something like that. And there was a bhikkhu called Bahusruta, means much learned. He consulted the arahants and the king. He was very critical of part of my Sutta Vinaya, making problems for those learning. Remembering that this is all spoken as a prophecy by the Buddha, put in the Buddha's mouth. Okay, Shariputra asking the Buddha, and he's giving a prophecy of the future. That's why he says, my Sutta Vinaya. At that time, there was an elder bhikkhu very famous for his learning. He urgently made criticisms of the treatise. He started to greatly expand my Vinaya, which was established by Kassapa and called the Mahasangika Vinaya. Alright? So, according to this treatise, Mahasangika Vinaya was the original Vinaya of Kassapa. That which was edited by outsiders deceived all the new learners. They formed separate parties, each saying they were right and the other was wrong. At that time there was a bhikkhu seeking the king's judgment. The king gathered the two sections and prepared black and white tally sticks. He announced to the assembly, if you prefer the old vinaya, take a black stick. If you prefer the new vinaya, take a white stick. At that time those taking the black stick numbered 10,000, while those taking the white stick were only 100. The king accordingly made all the Buddha's words. They harmoniously separated and did not share a common dwelling. Again, this is the Chinese is very poor for this text, notoriously poor, so this is one of the reasons the translation is quite rough. The majority who trained in the old vinaya were called Mahasangika. The minority who trained in the new vinaya were the elders, and they were called the Staviras. Yeah. So from the... Then it talks about the arising of all the schools, and we have the similar Sarvastivadin, Swatiputriya, Dharmotriya, Sanagarika, Sanitya, same list of schools that we found before. And again, the story, the background story is completely different. The list of schools is pretty much the same. This text means the Mahasangika Vinaya. Yeah, is the old vinaya of Kassapa. According to the Theravadins' point of view. Here it's the other way around. Yeah, here it's the Theravadins who are adding many things to the vinaya. Yeah.
They're all of them
taking accusing. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
But this source
isn't Mahasangika. No, it is. This is Mahasangika. This is the Mahasangika source, yeah. Shariputra Paribrichha. Yeah.
So when you say this old one is based on our Kassapa there.
Yep.
Is that the same as the person I know of as Mahakassapa?
Yes.
Oh, he's okay.
That's right. Yep. So this is because Kassapa was in charge at the first council.
Yeah,
they're saying that was that vinaya.
Yeah.
That's what they're saying, yeah. Of course, every school says that their vinaya was the one of Kassapa.
Yeah, yeah.
At that time. So this is, you know, why it shows that you can't just take the point of view of one school and just assume that that is the only story. Yeah? Everyone has their story, yeah? And they've all got something to say. what is this vineyard that they put many things into, right? They greatly expanded the vineyard. What is the greatly expanded vineyard? Well, there's one vineyard which is about 10 times as long as other vineyards, and that vineyard is the vineyard of Mathura, which is called the Mulasavasivada vineyard. All of them are expanded. One of them is expanded a lot more than all the others. Yeah? That's the Tibetan vineyard.
Yeah.
They don't use it because it's too big. Yeah? And they put too much stuff in it, so they use the commentaries. So we can't say what that was. But it's possible. It's possible that this is a local record of a local dispute in Mathura. We know that Buddhism was resurgent in Mathura at that time, 1st, 2nd century AD. We know that both the Mahasanghikas and the Sarvastivadins were present in Mathura. We have inscriptions with their names on it at that time. Right? We know that this Mahasanghika text claims Upagupta and Shanakavasan, the local saints of Mathura, as their predecessors. And we know that Sarvastivadins also claim the same monks as their predecessors. Yeah? I mean, there are arahants who are, especially Upagupta, who is known from that region. He's not like a pan-Indian, he's not like Sariputra Moggallana, who's recognised everywhere. So it'd be like, say, Ajahn Chah, you know, he's like the local saint of Ubon, you know. Might have some recognition in others, but sort of tends to be centred in that one place. So this is Upagupta and Shanakavasan, very closely associated with Mathura. So when you put all of those things together, it suggests that maybe the Mulasavasivada vineyard is the one that's being talked about here, and it's the record of a dispute in the 1st or 2nd century, say 1st century, between Mahasanghika, the local school of Mahasanghika, and Sarvastivada.
So you think the separation when do you think this? Or the text, like you said, many people kind of believe that it's after the Second Council.
Right.
But then also, you're saying that a lot of these texts are actually written so much after.
That's right, much later. Happened.
So
yeah.
When do you think the period of
what in this? I think this text is giving us the most plausible chronology. Okay, what this says is during time of Ashoka, basically everything's fine. Time of Ashoka's grandson, maybe the next generation, then the schisms start to appear. So you're talking maybe 100 BC, something like that. And to me, that's very plausible because it's saying that, well, Buddhism spread over India during the time of Ashoka, and according to the Pali account of that schism, it was quite harmonious. All these monks went to different places. But then, of course, gradually they developed their local traditions, and then the schisms came out of that. So to me, it seems reasonable that there was that period, post-Ashokan period, say the 200 years after Ashoka, that the schisms started to happen, or the separate schools started to have their own sense of self-identity. This chronology was criticized by Lamotte, but he was mistaken and didn't represent the Chinese text accurately. Actually, the chronology here is perfectly makes perfect sense, and it actually also agrees with the archaeological record as far as that has any, as far as we can tell. Down here, yeah.
Magnolia
robes, yeah. So I don't think that they really had different robe colours, but another interesting thing. Yeah. But again, this is the interesting thing. I put this at the beginning of sects and sectarianism. This, again, contrasting with the deeper Wangsa. Mahasanghika studied the collected suttas and taught the real meaning because they were placed in the basis at the middle. They wore yellow robes. The Dharmaguptakas mastered the ultimate taste guide to benefit. I don't know if that's a recipe book or something. It's difficult. Externally, they practiced a different speciality and they wore red robes. Sarvasivadin school gained quick, unobstructed knowledges using the Dhamma Vinita as their guide. They wear white robes. The Kashyapiya school are diligent and energetic in guarding sentient beings. They wear magnolia robes. Maheshi Astakas practice jhana and penetrate the subtle and obscure. They wear blue robes. And so it's very interesting, that different perspective on the text, yeah, on the different schools, that, you know, they're finding something to praise about each one of the schools. They've got their different specialities and so on. I can't work out exactly what each one of those means, but the sense of it is clear enough. Possibly not, if they're down in Sri Lanka and, yeah, not mentioned there. I'm not sure.
But they're seeing almost like backhanded compliments, really, aren't they? Well, these ones are off with the fairies collecting butterflies, but the our school were rigged in the jhanas and carrying the obscure and the subtle.
In the. Let's see if it mentions the Charvadas down here. See, one of the interesting things, it also says here, Mogaliputta, again, the elder mentioned in the Pali account, as the leader of the Pali school, the third council. Gives rise to the Dharmaguptaka. Okay? So here it's saying, just as Yonaka Dhammarakita was the student of Mogaliputta Tessa, sent out by him. In the Pali text here it says Mogaliputta gave rise to the Dharmaguptaka. Again, showing it wasn't a schism there. But I don't think it mentions specifically the Sri Lankan schools down here. It's very hard to render the tenses, yeah, especially you don't have tenses in the Chinese.
Oh, no.
No. Yeah. It's a historical future, yeah.
How do you represent the future or the past of the
tenses? You can use special words to indicate the future and past, but they're not sort of embedded in the language. So you can omit them if you want. So, yeah, so then you're talking about a text written in 2nd century, supposedly spoken in the 4th century BC about events 1st century BC, and then you don't have any tenses in the, yeah, it's not easy here. So this is the old Shariputra Pariparita. So I'd like to complete this translation one day. It's never been translated into English. That would be a nice thing to do sometime.
So what's that to do with the opinions?
Yeah, well, the question is, if the Vinaya question is, if there's a schism, formal legal Vinaya schism, then those two groups cannot perform Sanghakarma together. So you can't do ordinations together. Right? So, say for example, with Devadatta, he led his group off, and they formed a different group. They deliberately performed a posita within the same boundary, the same sima, with the intent to cause a schism, and they did that, and they caused a schism and broke the Sangha, yeah, and he led his disciples off. Now, once that had happened, it would be impossible, according to the Vinaya, for those 2 months to perform Sanghakarma together. They're forever split down the middle. Yeah? And so then the question is, historically, did the schools of Buddhism arise through that kind of process? If it did, then someone coming from a Vinaya legal point of view would say it's impossible for monks from a Theravada tradition to perform Uposatha together with monks from a Korean tradition. It would be impossible for monks from a Tibetan tradition to perform Uposatha with monks from a Taiwanese tradition, or to perform ordination together, or any of those formal acts of the Sangha. Yeah? So, as it seems that the origins of the school wasn't because of schism in that case, then that particular objection to Bhikkhuni ordination fails. So it's a kind of a roundabout way of getting there, but it's all going to turn up all this interesting stuff in the meantime.
But it was
good. Belief. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And because they're different. And the...
Because they're right. The...
Really, the surprising thing which I found was, you know, not just that generally speaking there wasn't schism in the formal sense, but more specifically how very closely, specifically the Dharmaguptaka, the Theravadan Sri Lankan school and the Mulasarvasivada, how closely all they were linked, and especially all revolving around that monastery in Mathura and that time, Yonaka Dhammarakita. Okay, so that's So we're back next week. Another fun-filled episode. Next week, Abhidhamma.